Scholars often deride such efforts as brainwashing, failing to understand that in democracies, citizens view war as a last resort, something abnormal. Contrary to how propaganda is portrayed, manipulating the public to do something against its collective will, wartime propaganda is often obviously accepted and enthusiastically received as a means of preparing a republic for the grim task ahead. George Creel, a Denver journalist, supported this effort with his Committee on Public Information, which provided posters and distributed war literature. The committee encouraged citizens to report anyone engaging in anti-war behavior to the Justice Department. Creel used his contacts in journalism to encourage fellow reporters to monitor their coverage of the war. Of course, abuses occurred. Germans in the United States became the objects of suspicion and, occasionally, violence. One German immigrant was lynched in St. Louis. Ultimately, the distrust spread to all immigrants, as seen in the Immigration Restriction Act of 1917, which refused admission to any adult immigrant who could not pass a basic reading test. Prohibition, in part, reflected the anti-immigrant attitudes fanned by the war because of a belief that Germans and others brought a drinking culture to the United States. And the most significant piece of legislation, the Espionage, Sabotage, and Sedition Acts of 1917 and 1918, extended the bounds of what was considered sabotage or espionage to include slandering the Constitution or the military. The Postmaster General blocked mailings of Socialist Party materials. But even if somewhat censored, the press continued to report. Congress continued to meet and pass laws. In fact, Wilson vetoed the Immigration Act, and people still experienced a level of freedom unseen in most of the world during peacetime. The progressives had been looking for an opportunity to nationalize elements of the economy. John Dewey beamed that wartime pressure would force Americans to give up much of our economic freedom. We shall have to lay by our good-natured individualism and march in step. Another progressive, Randolph Bourne, immediately saw the affinity for progressive big government centralizers and the war. It is as if the war and progressives have been waiting for each other. With the public support of combat sufficiently ratcheted up, the administration turned to financing and supply. The Federal Reserve facilitated bond sales and helped prevent wartime profiteering, and income tax rates skyrocketed to provide further cash. And only later was it discovered that the revenues collected from the rich plummeted with each rate increase. Much of the credit for organizing the finance and supply effort at home went to the Secretary of the Treasury, William McAdoo, who organized the War Finance Corporation, WFC. The idea was to facilitate the conversion of civilian production, such as Ford's motor plants, into factories turning out war materiel. At first, however, even with McAdoo's genius, the WFC's effort was helter-skelter. Companies made too many of the same parts, there were no priorities established, and the government lacked an overall strategy concerning which items to buy and in what order. To be sure, this fostered some profiteering, the infamous merchants of death. But in most cases, the lack of direction caused redundancies and inefficiency. It took almost a year before McAdoo figured it out, handing the job over in March 1918 to a new organization, the War Industries Board, WIB, under the direction of South Carolina millionaire and Wall Street tycoon Bernard Baruch. The new boss, who had come from the business sector and was not a lifetime bureaucrat, immediately perceived that besides priorities, what the government lacked was a business approach to procurement. He also knew that business leaders needed to take control of the production if it was to have any chance of succeeding. Reviving the successful productive practices of the Civil War, when government encouraged private enterprise to provide the weapons of war, Baruch permitted industrialists to charge high prices for their products, a feature that would be repeated yet again with equally stunning success in the next World War. He persuaded Wilson's Justice Department to call off the antitrust dogs, exempting many businesses from investigation as monopolies, while at the same time chastising any companies that did not comply with WIB requests. Baruch also persuaded successful corporate leaders to head up important procurement agencies and boards for a token fee of $1 a year, hence their name, the Dollar a Year Men. The approach worked. In short order, the businessmen had the war industry churning out supplies and machines, all according to a master plan Baruch and McAdoo had mapped out with Wilson and the War Department. Raising a legitimate ground force capable of going toe-to-toe with the Germans presented an equally daunting challenge. The U.S. Army, except for the Civil War, had never been particularly large and had atrophied since the Spanish-American War. Total numbers, including reserves, reached perhaps 307,000. For perspective, one should consider that at the Somme Offensive in 1916, the British lost more than 131,000 dead, including almost 20,000 on the first day, the French 204,000 total casualties for the campaign, and the Germans 160,000. Put another way, in one major battle, the combatants had lost more men than even existed in the entire U.S. Army of 1917. Not only was the army small, it was inexperienced, although many troops had fought in Cuba and the Filipino Rebellion. But only a few commanders had had wartime experience in Cuba, the Philippines, or the Mexico expedition, most notably George Catlett Marshall, Douglas MacArthur, and Black Jack Pershing. Another Pancho Villa chaser who joined Pershing's American Expeditionary Force was Cavalry Officer George S. Patton, already training in the Revolutionary War vehicle known as the Tank. Roosevelt, as he had in the Spanish-American War, offered to raise another regiment of troops, but Wilson politely refused. To meet the need for men, Wilson and Secretary of War Newton Baker pushed through Congress the Selective Service Act, or a draft. 3 million men came into the Army through the draft, and 2 million more volunteered for service. More than 240,000 black troops entered the armed services, with most of them serving in France. Blacks had a greater chance of being drafted, but a far smaller likelihood than whites of seeing combat. Nevertheless, one of the most famous black combat outfits, the 369th Infantry, was in the trenches for almost 200 days, and the entire regiment received the Croix de Guerre for heroism from the French government. In addition, 171 individual soldiers and officers were cited for their courage under fire. Other ethnic groups served in disproportionate numbers, especially German Americans, and overall 20% of the draftees were born in another country. A typical draftee was a second or third generation immigrant like Jean-Pierre Godet, who enlisted in the Army in November 1917. At the time of Godet's enlistment, the young man's unnamed father wrote to his sister the conflicting emotions that gripped every soldier's parent at that moment. "Today is November 3rd, and Jean-Pierre was sworn into the infantry. I cannot tell you the mixed sense of joy and pain I have felt upon his leaving for the war. I cannot withhold Jean-Pierre and forbid him to take part in the army, for the importance of this war is hard to estimate. I feel a strange contradiction between my love for Jean-Pierre and my love for America. It is difficult to surrender my son that my country may be free. On the other hand, without the willingness of all Americans to make these kinds of sacrifices, neither the country nor the world would long remain free." Thousands more did not fight, but served in or worked to advance the Red Cross, including Lewis Douglas, future budget director under Franklin Roosevelt, advertising executive Bruce Barton, and a budding artist named Walt Disney. Indeed, two of the men most responsible for the symbolic view of America that evolved by the 1960s, Disney and McDonald's founder Ray Kroc, crossed each other's path in the Red Cross in France. Still thousands more plowed to the fence for national defense on their farms and raised beef and sheep on their ranches. Britain and France had few doubts that the doughboys would arrive and weigh heavily on the scale of battle. Their concern, however, was that the war at sea would be lost before the Americans ever set foot in France. America's Rear Admiral William S. Sims, after meeting with Sir John Jellicoe in London regarding the shipping situation, admitted that the German U-boat campaign was succeeding. At the then-current rates of losses, by fall of 1917, the U-boats would be sinking more vessels than could be built. Sims then helped design the convoy system, akin to the frontier wagon trains, making it easier to protect merchant ships. The convoy system worked like a charm, because it turned the chief strength of the U-boats, their stealth, into a weakness, by forcing them to reveal themselves in an attack. Once they struck, U-boats could not escape the escort vehicles easily. This turn of events and the addition of American ships had a decided effect, drastically reducing losses from submarines. In April 1917 alone, before the United States joined the war, the Allies lost 900,000 tons of shipping. But by December, the convoy system had cut that monthly number to 400,000. Thus, even before American soldiers could make a difference on the ground, the U.S. Navy had ensured Germany could not win at sea. With the seas under Allied control, American troops departed for Europe. In July 1917, the U.S. 1st Infantry Division left for France, where it was greeted by Pershing himself. Pershing, lacking oratory skill, sent Colonel Charles Stanton to meet the men, and it was he who uttered the famous phrase, "Lafayette, we are here." Black Jack did not need flowery or emotional speeches. He had gained his fame in the Spanish-American War, charging San Juan Hill next to Roosevelt's Rough Riders. Pershing kept himself in almost robot-like control, and even his voice was monotone. But he was as fine a commander as any nation put in the field. One of his first instructions was to begin laying 22,000 miles of new telephone line connecting the Army Signal Corps to the coast. He also pressured the War Department to hire 400 female American telephone operators fluent in French to ensure reliable communications. Again, this was made possible in part by the Americans' pre-existing familiarity with the technology. Above all, the general understood that he could not allow the French to incorporate small, untrained American units into French forces as mere reinforcements. He certainly did not intend for them to be chewed up in the frontal assaults as the best of European manhood had been in the previous 3 years. Nor would a single division tilt the scales much. Pershing intended to deploy 3 million American troops in France by May 1918, but until then, the American Expeditionary Force had to resist sending brigade-sized replacements to the British or French. After 100,000 Yanks had arrived, they took up positions near the Swiss border, and on October 23, 1917, Alex Arch, an artillery sergeant, fired the first American shots at the Germans, and a few nights later, the United States took her first war casualties. By that time, virtually every aspect of the war was working against Germany. The U-boat war had failed and would never reach the level of effectiveness it had had in the spring of 1917. At the same time, the British blockade was starving Germany. In late 1917, the British unleashed a massive attack spearheaded by 300 of the new wonder weapons, the tanks, gaining more ground in a single day than in months of fighting in previous battles. Although the Germans regrouped, the carefully deployed and supported tank units doomed trench warfare once and for all, even if it was not readily apparent due to the mechanical failures of the machines. This made the Germans increasingly desperate, accounting for their offensive in early 1918. Pershing appreciated the delicate situation in which either Germany or France could collapse. Writing Wilson's advisor, Colonel Edward House, he stated, "The Allies are done for, and the only thing that will hold them, especially France, in the war will be the assurance that we have enough forces to assume the initiative." By midsummer 1918, French officers rejoiced at the sight of American armies. Life was coming in floods to reanimate the dying body of France. Indeed, that May, with the additional U.S. troops, the Allies now had about 3 million men on the Western Front facing 3.5 million Germans. The Germans' advance of 42 divisions in mid-1918 swept away British troops and came within 80 miles of Paris, which began a general evacuation until American Marines appeared on the roads. They were thrown into a gap at Chateau Thierry and Belleau Wood, and when the Marines took up their positions, they dug no trenches for fallback positions. "The Marines will hold where they stand," said Brigadier General James Harbord, and they did, although the press misidentified the men as Army doughboys, starting a friendly rivalry between regular Army and Marines, each seeking to outdo the other in military glory. American troops counterattacked on June 26th, driving the Germans out of the areas near Paris and stunning the German general staff, which had to reconsider its offensive. General Erich Ludendorff, in charge of war production, ordered aircraft production doubled to offset the Yankee units. More desperate German offensives followed. Douglas MacArthur, an American officer facing the June-July attacks, witnessed one of the final German assaults on the Western Front. Despite a barrage of more than 500,000 gas shells, the Germans could not break through. German forces slammed into unbroken barbed wire barriers defended by U.S. doughboys blazing away with machine guns. MacArthur, who would be criticized for his seeming absence of compassion in the Bonus Army charge, later recalled that he was haunted by the vision of those writhing bodies hanging from the barbed wire. When the Allied forces counterattacked, MacArthur found the enemy exhausted, uncoordinated, and shattered. Across the lines, one of those exhausted and shattered soldiers, Corporal Adolf Hitler, was awarded an Iron Cross Second Class for personal bravery by a Jew, Captain Hugo Gutmann. And at the time Gutmann decorated Adolf Hitler, the American Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, visited the battle zone and fired an artillery piece in Hitler's direction. A few hours later, Roosevelt watched 200 tired and wounded American soldiers moving to the rear, all that remained of a regiment of 1,000 that had advanced merely 2 days before. In Sherman-esque fashion, the American troops continued to advance, not giving the German army a chance to regroup. In early September at Saint Mihiel, American forces slammed into retreating German units and probably could have taken Metz. But Field Marshal Foch, the commander-in-chief of the Allied troops, had another strategy that shifted the American First Army west to the Meuse-Argonne Forest along a massive and broad front. It was here that the greatest tale of American heroism from the Great War emerged. Sergeant Alvin York was a Tennessee turkey shooting champion and conscientious objector when the war began, but he was persuaded by his pastor to join the war effort. Part of the 82nd Division, York's platoon became separated from the main body, and fighting his way back with only a handful of men, York killed 25 enemy soldiers, took out 35 German machine guns, and took 132 prisoners. Germans' heads, the Tennessean noted, were so much bigger than the turkeys' heads. Even York's heroism paled beside that of Dan Edwards. Edwards's exploits, although somewhat diminished by his tendency later in life to embellish, were nevertheless remarkable. With his arm crushed by a tree felled by artillery fire, Edwards confronted 8 Germans who advanced toward him. He drew his revolver with his remaining free hand and shot 4 Germans, then took the other 4 prisoner. When yet another explosion broke his leg, he ordered the Germans to carry him. The offensive had broken the back of the German army, and Ludendorff knew it. Only months earlier, French troops had mutinied, but now riots occurred in German shipyards and cities. In August, the Austrian foreign minister informed the Germans that his nation would seek a separate peace negotiation. German troops were ordered to evacuate forward positions rather than face encirclement and death. As the Kaiser's inner circle grew more desperate for an armistice, they told the insecure Wilhelm that peace feelers they had sent to Wilson had been squelched by the demand that the Kaiser step down as a precondition to an armistice. A shaken Wilhelm, whose cousin, Tsar Nicholas II, had recently been executed by Lenin's Bolsheviks, agreed to change the German constitution to allow for a parliamentary government. On November 9, 1918, a new republic was established in Berlin, and the Kaiser boarded an imperial train for neutral Holland. Pershing warned that the fighting needed to continue until the Allies obtained an unconditional surrender, not a ceasefire. "What I dread is that Germany doesn't know that she is licked. Had they given us another week, we'd have taught them." But it was out of his hands. At 11 a.m. on November 11, 1918, a silence fell over the bloody battlefields of Europe, ending the costliest war in European history. The ceasefire was announced around 5 o'clock in the morning Paris time, indicating 11 o'clock as the appointed armistice hour. Harry Truman, commanding a battery of the 129th Field Artillery, fired his last shell just a few minutes before the set time, having received orders to keep fighting until the actual armistice hour. Ironically, Truman, at least indirectly, may have fired the last shots of both world wars, one at his artillery station in France, and another through his order to drop the second atomic bomb on Nagasaki in Japan. When the shooting stopped, the United States was fortunate that its casualty lists were considerably shorter than those of the other participants. The numbers of dead were mind-numbing. 1.8 million Germans, 1.7 million Russians, 1.4 million French, 1.3 million Austrians, and 947,000 British or Commonwealth troops. American losses were staggeringly light by comparison. The nation soberly absorbed the actual battle deaths for the American Expeditionary Force, which stood at 48,909, although a total of 112,432 soldiers and sailors had died in all theaters of all causes in a conflict not of their own making. Wilson, meanwhile, had already outlined a proposal for ensuring, in his mind, that another such war would never occur. He had labeled his program the 14 Points, yet even before the armistice had taken effect, 11 German cities were flying the communist red flag of revolution. Germany had deteriorated into chaos before Wilson even boarded the vessel sailing to France for the peace conference. Germany was not the only European power whose collapse involved the United States. To the east, Russia had disintegrated in the face of anti-war protests and the skillful maneuvering of the diabolical V.I. Lenin, Russia's Red Sun, who would spawn the first communist state of the 20th century. Red Sun Rising. Amid the sea of blood and America's entry into the Great War, Russia's Second Revolution went almost unnoticed, but not for long. In October 1917, Vladimir Lenin and a tiny corps of radically committed Bolshevik communists took the Russian government by force, grabbing the key centers of communication and controlling the legislature. Estimates put the number of loyal Leninist supporters in Russia at no more than 20,000 in a nation of 160 million. But with zealous fervor and unshakable focus, the Bolsheviks seized near-total power in a few months. Lenin's puppet legislature announced an immediate end to hostilities with Germany, freeing millions of Germany's Eastern Front troops for service against the newly arrived Yankee forces. During the civil war that followed between communist forces, Reds, and non-communists, Whites, the United States and the Allies sent expedition forces in support of the Whites to hold open the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Anglo-American troops landed to secure objectives imperative to the Allies' war effort. The invasion, rather than changing communist attitudes, only confirmed in the minds of the Bolsheviks the status of the United States as an enemy. Wilson, despite his progressivism, was already viewed by Lenin as the head of the American multimillionaires and servant of capitalist sharks. And this seemed only to confirm it. Lenin announced peace on November 8, 1917, one day after seizing power, although a genuine ceasefire did not occur until December 15, followed by the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, 1918. The West's invasion later aided the Soviet propaganda line that the United States and other capitalist nations had arrayed themselves against communism in its infancy. Few Europeans or Americans, Churchill excepted, saw the menace posed by a communist government in such a large, resource-rich nation. Quite the contrary, many American intellectuals welcomed the communist movement in Russia as a harbinger of what should happen next in America. It did not matter that Joseph Stalin's minister, Vyacheslav Molotov, could sign the death sentences of 3,187 people in just one night and then watch Western movies with Stalin with a pure conscience. When Stalin later claimed his show trials were fair, the New Republic accepted his explanations at face value. Owen Lattimore commented that, "The executions of dissidents sounds like democracy to me." Lattimore would be revealed in the 1950s as a Soviet accomplice, if not outright agent. Harry Ward, a professor of Christian ethics at Union Theological Seminary in New York, compared the Soviet system with the teachings of Jesus. From 1919 on, large numbers of the intelligentsia in the United States ignored or downplayed Lenin's and Stalin's atrocities, hiding behind the lack of first-hand evidence about the actual brutality of the regime. Not only was the American media complicit in omitting any hint of Soviet repression, but reporters such as Walter Duranty of the New York Times actively covered up mass starvation, torture by the secret police, and executions, suppressing any and all reports of communist evils. Another Westerner, Roger Baldwin, was lauded by Soviet Russia, even though he privately wrote to his mother, "Everybody is poor together." He added, "There is much discontent, much regulation of life, but not much terrorism." At home, however, the communist movement could not cover up its activities. In April 1919, New York City postal clerks found 20 package bombs addressed to public officials and caught all but two of the saboteurs. The undetected bombs exploded at the Attorney General's house, blowing a delivery man to pieces. And another exploded at a U.S. senator's house, shattering the arm of a maid. Outraged citizens supported immediate action, which, with Senate approval, the Justice Department took by launching a series of raids on suspected communists. Authorized by Attorney General Mitchell Palmer, the raids, directed by Palmer's assistant J. Edgar Hoover, smashed the communist movement in the United States. A team of lawyers claiming that the government's attacks endangered civil liberties for all citizens resisted the raids and eventually forced Palmer's resignation, but not before he had reduced membership in the American Communist Party and its allies by 80%. The remaining communists might have remained underground and harmless after the war, but for a sensational murder trial of two anarchists, Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, who were convicted of a Braintree, Massachusetts robbery and murder in 1921. Both supporters and opponents misidentified the pair as communists, when in fact they were anarchists, and both sides saw the case as a test of the government's position on radicals. The two were executed on solid evidence, and attempts to portray the trial as rigged have not stood up. In any event, the prosperity of the 1920s soon combined with the concerns about anarchism to blunt any further spread of communism in the United States. Sacco and Vanzetti forged an important bond between communists and their liberal sympathizers, a bond that resurfaced during the Great Depression and the rise of fascism in the 1930s. Versailles and the 14 Points. As events in Bolshevik Russia unfolded, they had a direct impact on Wilson's philosophy of foreign policy. Lenin had already, in December 1917, issued a declaration of his government's war aims, which was in many ways a formality. He intended to get out of the war as quickly as possible. Partly in response to the Soviet proposals, in January 1918, Wilson offered his own program, known as the 14 Points, which in some ways mirrored Lenin's suggestions. Although the president hoped Russia could be persuaded to stay in the war, he soon realized that Lenin was now a competitor in the effort to lead the post-war order. In 1918, Wilson, the social scientist, had convened a panel of 150 academic experts to craft a peace plan under the direction of his close advisor, Colonel Edward House. Some observers, including British diplomatic historian Harold Nicholson, were impressed by this illustrious group, asserting it had produced one of the wisest documents in history. Others remained skeptical of foreign policy drafted by an academic elite. Attracted to numbers and categories, Wilson outlined 5 points that related to international relations, including open covenants, a concession to Lenin who had already made public all the treaties Russia had secretly made prior to the revolution, freedom of the seas, free trade, arms reductions, and review of colonial policies with an eye toward justice for the colonized peoples. Then Wilson added 8 more points addressing territorial claims after the war, including the return of Alsace-Lorraine to France, recovery of Russian and Italian territory from the Central Powers, establishment of a new Polish nation, and modifications in the Ottoman Empire to separate ethnic minorities into their own countries under the rubric of the Wilsonite phrase, national self-determination. That made 13 points, with the 14th consisting of a call for an international congress to discuss and deliberate, even to act as an international policeman to prevent future wars. Before anyone in the international community could absorb even a few of the 14 points, Wilson inundated them with still more. In February, the 4 principles followed. Then in September 1918, the 5 particulars. All of this relentless drafting, pontificating, and above all, numbering, came during the bloody final months of the war, when some 9 million Germans still faced the Allied American armies, now without regard to the Eastern Front. The constant stream of points and principles and particulars gave the Germans the impression that the basis of an armistice was constantly in flux and negotiable. Consequently, in early October 1918, German and Austrian diplomats agreed to what they thought Wilson had offered, the 14 points. More accurately, the 14 points should have been called the American 14 points. Certainly the British and the French did not sign off on them, and no sooner had the Central Powers agreed to the stipulations than a secret meeting occurred between House and Anglo-French leaders where they introduced numerous caveats. The Allies changed or amended many of the most important passages. This Anglo-French commentary, as it was called, left the Allies everything and the Central Powers virtually nothing. It created a Polish corridor that divided Prussia. It broke up the Austro-Hungarian Empire and stripped Germany of overseas colonies. It changed Wilson's word compensation to a more harsh-sounding reparations, opening the door for the hated war guilt clause. Perhaps the worst feature of the 14 points, besides deceiving Germany after a deal had been offered and accepted, was that it proffered a phony explanation of the war itself with the Central Powers the sole villains. It excused Britain and France from their own desire for territory and dominance. To be sure, Germany had struck first. The Germans had engaged in unrestricted submarine warfare, which had already been demonized as inhuman. Germany had used zeppelins to bomb London civilians and had introduced the flamethrower, and Germany had smugly thought she could launch a last-minute offensive and smash France as late as 1918. But it would be unrealistic to ignore the British and French, not to mention Russian and Serbian, culpability in starting the war. Indeed, when comparing the relatively mild treatment post-Napoleonic France had received after Waterloo by the Congress of Vienna, which followed a period of constant war that lasted three times longer than World War I, Germany was unfairly punished in 1919. Wilson set the stage for such international malfeasance by his Make the World Safe for Democracy comments in the original war message, indicating he would not be satisfied until he had reshaped the world in the image of America. The Central Powers should have listened then. Instead, having accepted the 14 points as the grounds for the November 1918 armistice, they now found themselves excluded from the treaty process entirely, to be handed a Carthaginian peace. Nevertheless, when Wilson sailed for the peace conference in Paris on December 4, 1918, it is safe to say that he took the hopes of much of the world with him. His arrival in Europe was messianic in tone, the cheers of the people echoing a desperate longing that this American leader might end centuries of continental conflict. The stiff-necked, humorless, self-righteous, and Puritan Wilson lapped up the adulation. European leaders may have privately scoffed at the president. The French premier Georges Clemenceau dourly said, "The 14 points bore me. God Almighty has only 10. But the masses embraced him. Wilson's reception in part involved a natural euphoria over the termination of the war, akin to the brief era of good feelings that had surfaced between the North and South in the weeks following Appomattox. Personally attending the conference, while good for Wilson's ego, proved a fatal political mistake. Other representatives, by nature of their parliamentary systems, already had the support of their legislatures. The Constitution, however, required the president to obtain Senate ratification of treaties. By participating personally, Wilson lost some of the aura of a deity from a distance that had won him the adoration of the French. Unfortunately, Wilson's lofty phrases did not easily translate into genuine policy with teeth. For example, the national self-determination, while apparently sensible, was an idea fraught with danger. Carving a new Poland out of parts of Germany and Russia failed to take into account the many decades when an aggressive Poland had waged war to expand her boundaries in the past. Nor did the Ottoman Empire get off easily. Palestine, Mesopotamia, later Iraq, and Syria were sliced off and handed to the League of Nations as trust territories, as was Armenia, though too late to save the 500,000 Armenian civilians slaughtered by the Turkish government. Wilson did not originally insist on establishing completely new states such as Czechoslovakia or recreating countries such as Poland, only autonomy within empires. But by October 16, 1918, while the guns still blazed, Wilson had upped the ante to require statehood status. Perversely, the Allies now lobbied for entire Slavic and Slovakian states that would themselves subordinate Serbs, Croats, Slovenians, and Albanians, and other groups trapped within the new nationalities. Wilson had moved in less than 4 years from neutral in thought and deed to outright hostility toward Germany and Austria-Hungary. But all this merely put on paper what Wilson had been repeating since 1916, when he made his self-determination of peoples speech. Upon hearing the phrase, Robert Lansing, Wilson's counselor to the State Department, recoiled. The president, he wrote, was a phrase-maker par excellence. He admires trite sayings and revels in formulating them. But he apparently never thought out in advance where they would lead or how they would be interpreted by others. Lansing later wrote in his diary, "The phrase is simply loaded with dynamite. It will raise hopes which can never be realized. What misery it will cause! Think of the feelings of the author when he counts the dead who died because he coined a phrase." Other punitive clauses reduced the army to a rump, eliminated Germany's navy, as well as stripped her rich industrial territories, and imposed massive reparations. These included not only direct gold payments, but also the construction of ships and railroad cars that the Germans had to offer to the British and French free of charge. All of these constituted massive and foolish economic dislocations that helped send Europe into a depression within a few years. Where the treaty was not self-contradictory, it was mean, vindictive, and, at the same time, ambiguous. The phrases avoided specifics, falling back on the reformist language of freedom, respect, and observing the rights of nations. Which were? Wilson could not, or at least did not, say. Nations had to be respected, except for Germany, which had to be taught a lesson. In that regard, the French were much more pragmatic, seeking a mutual security pact with the United States and Britain. Instead, Wilson pressed for universal participation in the League of Nations, which the French knew would soon include France's enemies. More damaging, at least in the eyes of U.S. Senate critics of the treaty, the League threatened to draw the United States into colonial conflicts to maintain the Europeans' grip in Africa and Asia, a concept fundamentally at odds with America's heritage of revolution and independence. Satisfied they had emasculated the Central Powers and at the same time made the world safe for democracy, Great Britain, France, the United States, Italy, and other participants signed the Treaty of Versailles in June 1919. Within 10 years, its provisions would accelerate German economic chaos, European unemployment, and, at least indirectly, the rise of Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini. Returning to the United States with the treaty in hand, Wilson faced a skeptical Senate, now in the hands of the Republicans, who had won both houses in the 1918 off-year elections, despite Wilson's claim that a Republican election would embarrass the nation. Opposition to the treaty in the Senate was led by Henry Cabot Lodge, Massachusetts, and William Borah, Idaho. Lodge, chairman of the Senate Armed Forces Committee, disagreed less with the intent of the treaty or its likelihood to involve the nation in foreign conflicts than he did with the imprecision of its wording, which was, in his opinion, too open-ended. The public agreed with the general premise of a worldwide peacekeeping body, but needed to be convinced that the League would be feasible and effective. Attempting to add specificity, Lodge introduced his own reservations to the treaty. Other opponents, however, including the progressive wing of the party led by Robert La Follette, Hiram Johnson, and Borah, had voted against going to war in the first place and continued to reject any post-war European involvement. Many Democrats, including Bryan and Colonel House, as well as members of Wilson's own cabinet, as well as Herbert Hoover, the head of the Food Administration, had reservations. Some argued that the League of Nations committed American boys to dying for nebulous and ill-defined international causes. This in itself violated the Constitution, and no American sailor, soldier, or marine had ever taken a vow to defend the League of Nations. Since virtually none of the opponents had been present at Versailles when Wilson had negotiated the final points, they didn't realize that he had already traded away the substance of any legitimate leverage the United States might have had in return for the shadow of a peace enforced by international means. Lodge rightly recognized that the notion that every separate ethnic group should have its own nation was hopelessly naive. Was French Quebec to declare independence from English Canada? Should the Mexican-dominated American Southwest attempt to create Aztlan? Branded an obstructionist, Lodge in fact controlled only 49 votes, some of which could have been swung by reasonable negotiations by Wilson. Instead, the stubborn president sought to go over the heads of the senators, making a whistle-stop tour touting the treaty. Speaking on behalf of the treaty, Wilson covered a remarkable 8,000 miles in 3 weeks, often from the back of his train at 37 different locations. Occasionally, he spoke 4 times a day, sometimes an hour at a time. Yet even in our age of instantaneous mass communication, such a strategy would involve great risk. Presidents are important, but not supreme. Wilson could count on reaching only a small handful of the population, and certainly not with the effect needed to shift entire blocks of votes in the Senate. Wilson was already in poor health, having suffered a stroke in April 1919 while still in Paris and concealing it from the public. In September, he had another stroke. Then on October 2nd, yet another. After the final stroke, Wilson remained debilitated and bedridden, out of touch with the American voter. Mrs. Edith Wilson thus became, in a manner of speaking, the first female president of the United States, though her role again was unknown to the general public. For more than a year, she determined whom Wilson saw, what he said, and what he wanted through notes that she crafted in a clumsy hand. When he was lucid, Edith arranged for Wilson to meet with staff and members of Congress, but most of the time he looked distant and dull. His speech was slurred, and he remained partly paralyzed, especially on his left side. Whether the stroke accounted for his unwillingness to negotiate any of Lodge's criticisms is uncertain, but whatever the cause, his cadre of supporters in the Senate failed to persuade a single vote to switch, sending the treaty down to defeat. And because Wilson would not entertain any of the Lodge reservations, indeed had ordered his loyal senators to vote against the Lodge version, in March 1920, the amended treaty also failed to pass. The defeated treaty symbolized the high watermark of international progressivism. Although it would take several years, a new, more realistic foreign policy would set in at the end of the Coolidge administration. If the progressives had failed in foreign policy, they were just getting started in areas of social reform, especially when it came to public health and woman suffrage. Progressive fervor and the real thing. America's war against alcohol began, oddly enough, with an attack on Coca-Cola. One of the first products challenged under the 1906 Food and Drug Act, Coke had eliminated even the minute portions of cocaine it had once used in the cooking process years before. The drink had originated with an Atlanta pharmacist, Dr. John Pemberton, and his Yankee advertiser, Frank Robinson, from a desire to create a cold drink that could be served over ice in the South to compete with hot coffee and tea. Pemberton had concocted the mixture from cola nuts, sugar, caffeine, caramel, citric acid, and a fluid extract of cocaine for a little euphoria. After Pemberton fell ill, Asa Griggs Candler, another pharmacist who suffered from frequent headaches, took over after discovering that Coke alleviated his pain. By that time, pharmaceutical tests had showed that Coca-Cola contained about 1/30th of a grain of cocaine, and even that was removed by the end of the process. Regardless, by 1900, Coca-Cola had no cocaine at all in its secret formula. Many progressives, especially Dr. Harvey Wiley, the leader of the government's case brought by the Food and Drug Administration in 1909-10, stalked Coke for some time and in general recklessly endorsed some products while condemning others. The case against Coke culminated in a 1911 Chattanooga trial. By that time, there were no trace elements of cocaine in the drink at all, and the government's own tests had proved it. This prompted Wiley to switch strategies by claiming that Coke's advertising was fraudulent because Coca-Cola did not contain cocaine. The effort to prosecute Coke went flat, but convinced progressive reformers that government could successfully litigate against products with proven health risks. An even darker side to progressive reforms when it came to health involved Wiley's formation of the so-called Poison Squad in 1902, which consisted of 12 young male clerks who volunteered to eat food treated with chemicals to test the toxicity of borax. Wiley switched the control group and the borax-fed group every 2 weeks in violation of modern proper scientific methodology, tainting his study from the outset. More important, however, was the entire conduct of the study, which soon was leaked by one of the human lab rats to the press, in which humans served as guinea pigs for the greater public good. Nothing better captured the progressive mindset than the notion that the health of the individual was irrelevant compared to the greater good. The Poison Squad ended its work after 5 years, and as late as 2002, the official Food and Drug Administration magazine described it as bad publicity for a good cause. Whether it was testing the effects of borax on young men or prosecuting a soft drink, the progressive mentality was on full display, and the effort to dictate people's intake of food and drink was only beginning. Wiley's effort to get Coke was a test run for the 18th Amendment, or the noble experiment of prohibition, which involved the direct intervention of government against both social mores and market forces, and more than any other movement, epitomized the reform tradition. Temperance had a long history in American politics. Maine passed the first state law banning the sale of alcohol in 1851, based on the studies of Neil Dow, a Portland businessman who claimed to have found a link between booze and family violence, crime, and poverty. Abraham Lincoln had run on a platform of temperance. For a while, eliminating alcohol seemed a necessary component of the women's movement as a means to rescue wives from drunken abuse and to keep the family wages from the saloon keeper. Alcohol, by way of the saloons, was linked to prostitution, and prostitution to the epidemic of venereal disease. Today, declared Dr. Prince Morrow, a specialist on sexually transmitted diseases, we recognize gonorrhea not only as the most widespread, but also one of the most serious of infective diseases. It has risen to the dignity of a public peril. Convinced that unfaithful husbands were bringing home syphilis, doctors warned of the syphilis of the innocent, infected wives and children. Then there was the alcohol-related problem of white slavery brought before the public eye in the 1913 play Damaged. At that point, a public clamor arose, and Congress reacted by passing the Mann Act of 1910, which prohibited the transport of women across state lines for the purpose of prostitution. When Prince Morrow died, groups such as the American Social Hygiene Association persuaded John D. Rockefeller Jr. and Grace Dodge to take over the leadership of the movement. Rockefeller, who had given thousands of dollars for studies and provided much of the annual budget, had served on special grand juries in New York investigating the white slave trade. Although the juries found no evidence of a syndicate, the experience convinced Rockefeller that there were responsible concerns about the damage done to society by venereal disease. He thus joined the thousands of other moral crusaders of the day, further cementing the relationship between planning, professionalism, and social reform. As one press release aptly put it, "The name Rockefeller stands for a type of efficiency and thoroughness of work." All of these streams of reform and the application of science and professional solutions came to a confluence over alcohol, particularly because the saloon was perceived as the hotbed of prostitution. Even the direct democracy movement played a significant role in eliminating booze. At the elementary school level, thanks to Massachusetts housewife Mary Hunt, a movement called Scientific Temperance Instruction swept the nation in the 1880s, providing a forerunner to Nancy Reagan's Just Say No anti-drug campaign a century later. Enlisting anti-alcohol crusaders from Connecticut to California, scientific temperance instruction in classrooms introduced scientific experts to support its prohibition position, leading a popular democratic movement to influence curricula. The Anti-Saloon League, founded in the 1890s, joined with the Women's Christian Temperance Union to use local laws to excise saloons within city boundaries, isolating them in wet areas. More than 40% of the population lived in dry communities by 1906, thanks to such local legislation. And within 3 years, the dry movement had spread to a dozen states, again through grassroots activism. Prohibition puts modern liberal historians in a quandary. On the one hand, they have approved of its use of federal power for social engineering for a purpose they deem desirable. But on the other hand, it ran counter to their unwillingness to pursue any policies based on morals or values. Consequently, historians have mischaracterized prohibition as cultural and class legislation, wherein progressive upper classes and Anglo-Saxons imposed their puritanical will on benign but besotted immigrants to mold an America that reflected their values, as one text described the progressives' efforts. Historian Richard Hofstadter called prohibition a parochial substitute for genuine reform carried about America by the rural evangelical virus. Such a view erred by lumping together two substantially different groups, the progressives and the rural populists. A stronger correlation existed with women and prohibition, leading dry counties to also permit universal suffrage. Only after prohibition failed was there a deliberate effort to reinterpret the essentially progressive flavor of prohibition as the work of wild-eyed Christian evangelists and populists, or as H.L. Mencken sneeringly put it, "ignorant bumpkins of the cow states." The amendment gained broad supermajority support from a wide range of groups, as was obvious by the fact that it was an amendment and not a statutory law. As prohibition historian Norman Clark wrote, A majority of the people in a majority of the states wanted this truly national effort to influence national morality. Doctors, teachers, upper-class reformers, rural preachers, labor leaders, and businessmen of all sorts supported prohibition. Under the amendment, the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors, consisting of any beverage with more than 0.5% alcohol, was prohibited. Unlike later laws against drug use, actually consuming alcohol was not a crime, and had enforcement been even remotely possible, prohibition may not have passed. Although a large majority of Americans, for a variety of motivations, supported the concept, it was not clear how many wished to provide the government with the means and the license to ensure compliance. A revealing look at the Janus-faced nature of progressive policy can be gleaned from the approach to enforcement of the anti-alcohol campaign. The Volstead Act, passed in 1919 over Wilson's veto, provided an enforcement mechanism, but instead of placing the Prohibition Bureau inside the Justice Department where it belonged, Volstead made it part of the Treasury Department. Revenuers broke up illegal stills, and agents crashed into speakeasies, and when the government had no other evidence, it charged mobsters with income tax evasion, which was what finally put Al Capone behind bars. Reform zeal during this time led to the formation of an anti-tuberculosis league in 1897, the American Conference for the Prevention of Infant Mortality in 1909, the National Mental Hygiene Committee that same year, the National Society for the Prevention of Blindness in 1915, and a half dozen more. The founding of the American Eugenics Society in 1923 by biologist Charles Davenport, Alexander Graham Bell, and Luther Burbank was more chilling. Indiana and California mandated sterilization of confirmed criminals, idiots, rapists, and imbeciles whose condition was viewed as incurable based on the recommendation of three physicians. All of these organizations and movements captured the progressive view that disease and imperfection of any kind could be reformed through human action. As with most other reform movements in America, prohibition started among upper-class females, and, as was often the case, the targets ultimately were lower-class men. According to the pietistic conscience, the lower classes were naturally the morally weaker classes, but predictably it was the pietist women who, after 1870, rushed toward political and social protest to save the family. And who could be numbered among these morally weaker classes? None other than immigrants, Irish, Italians, and Poles. In the eyes of progressive reformers, the drinking habits of the foreigners reinforced the political corruption where fat, cigar-smoking backroom Pauls mobilized armies of drunken immigrants to pad their machine's vote. Whether temperance itself was ever the sole objective of the women's group who participated in the prohibition movement invites skepticism. Many feminist leaders latched on to prohibition only as an organizational tool that would permit them to mobilize for the real effort, woman suffrage. Suffering for suffrage. Voting rights for women, another progressive plank, had a long history. Since the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848 calls for the Declaration of Independence to be applied to all people, not just all men, had increased in frequency and intensity. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who had organized the Seneca Women's Rights Convention, labeled it the duty of women to secure their sacred right to the elective franchise. Shortly after the Civil War, Stanton had formed the National Woman Suffrage Association, which wanted a constitutional amendment for female suffrage. That association soon pressed for other objectives, including birth control and easier divorce laws, and alienated some women who merely wanted the vote, and who in turn formed the American Woman Suffrage Association. The two merged in 1890 as the National American Woman Suffrage Association, largely made up of middle and upper-class reform-minded people of both sexes. The Wyoming Territory had granted voting rights to women in 1869, and when Wyoming petitioned to enter the Union 20 years later, Congress allowed the women's vote clause to stand in the new state constitution. In 1916, Wyoming's neighbor, Montana, elected Jeanette Pickering Rankin as the first woman to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives. Colorado voters changed their state's law in 1893 to permit female suffrage and were soon joined by their neighbors in Utah, which became a state in 1896 with women's suffrage. The trend seemed inevitable, and in 1919, Congress introduced the 19th Amendment to enfranchise adult women. The states ratified the amendment in 1920. Over the years, one of the most significant impacts of female voting rights has been a corollary increase in the size of government. Voting rights for women might have come sooner had the issue been restricted to the franchise alone. But activists, such as Margaret Sanger from New York City, had associated feminism with such controversial practices as birth control and eugenics. Sanger, one of 11 children, was deeply affected by the death of her tubercular mother. Instead of blaming the disease, Sanger blamed the rigors of childbirth for her mother's death. The difficult delivery of her own baby convinced her of the dangers of the birth process and the problems of poverty she associated with large families. Sanger quickly fell in with New York radicals and met all the important socialists, including Debs, Big Bill Haywood, John Reed, Clarence Darrow, Will Durant, and Upton Sinclair. She seemed supremely unimpressed by her fellow travelers. In addition to her disparaging remarks about Haywood and her silk hat radical reference to Debs, she called Alexander Beckman, a labor organizer, a hack, armchair socialist full of hot air but likely little else. Sanger bitterly attacked any fellow travelers, characterizing members of the Socialist Party as losers, complainers, and perpetual victims, unwilling or unable to do for themselves, much less society at large. What kept her in the good graces of the radical community was her libertine attitude and, above all, her willingness to link socialism to sexual liberation. Sanger published a paper called The Woman Rebel that advocated controls on the procreation of those she deemed unfit, including Jews and Italians. She denounced marriage as a degenerate institution and endorsed political assassinations. Her writings clearly violated the Comstock laws enacted in 1873 to prohibit the transmission of pornography or other obscene materials through the mail, and she was indicted. Rather than submit to jail, Sanger fled to England, where she absorbed the already discredited overpopulation ideas of Malthus. Suddenly, she found a way to package birth control in the less offensive wrapping of concern for population pressures. Although relabeling her program as family planning, in reality, Sanger associated birth control with population control, particularly among the unfit. The most merciful thing a large family could do to a new baby, she suggested, was to kill it. She attacked charity as enabling the dregs of society to escape natural selection. My criticism is not directed at the failure of philanthropy, but rather at its success. The dangers inherent in the very idea of humanitarianism and altruism have today produced their full harvest of human waste. Benevolence encouraged the perpetuation of defectives, delinquents, and dependents. Birth control and sterilization could be used to weed out the poor and, she noted, blacks and Chinese, whom she likened to a plague. She viewed birth control as a means of weeding out the unfit, aiming at the creation of a superman. Founding the Birth Control Review in 1917, Sanger published a number of pro-eugenics articles. Some Moral Aspects of Eugenics, June 1920, The Eugenic Conscience, February 1921, The Purpose of Eugenics, December 1924, Birth Control and Positive Eugenics, July 1925, and Birth Control, The True Eugenics, August 1928. One of her regular contributors, Norman Hines, repeatedly claimed that Catholic stock, that is, people from predominantly Catholic nations, was inferior to Protestant stock. Perhaps the most outrageous article published in Birth Control Review was a favorable book review of Lothrop Stoddard's The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, 1923, a book that became a model for fascist eugenics in Europe. Claiming that black children were destined to be a burden to themselves, to their family, and ultimately to the nation, Sanger revealed herself as a full-fledged racist. Mainstream feminists recognized the dangers posed by any association with the eugenics movement and distanced themselves from her views sufficiently enough to ensure passage of the 19th Amendment. Only later would they revive Sanger's positions under the benign-sounding name Planned Parenthood, which ironically became one of the leading proponents of abortion, one of the few anti-birth practices that Sanger actually opposed. The Dark Bargain. By 1920, the United States looked vastly different than it had at the turn of the century. Technology had changed life in dramatic ways. Progressive reforms had affected almost every aspect of daily life, and the large-scale economic reorganization that had started in the 1860s had reached maturity. Although the end of the war brought a large-scale depression in the agricultural sector, the nation nevertheless was perched to spread its wings. However, flight would require a drastic withdrawal from the progressive wartime assumptions and structures in every area of life. Candidate Warren G. Harding would call it a return to normalcy. But regardless of the term, exorbitant tax rates, large government debt, and price fixing would need to go. Wilson's exit marked the last gasp of progressivism until, arguably, 1933. That would have surprised many, especially since the pole star of progressive policy, prohibition, had just been enacted. Yet the contradictions of progressivism were precisely what it